Welcome to a podcast brought to you by the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Our academy is a national organization committed to excellence in orthopedic manual physical therapy practice, education, and research. And we're here to explore a wide range of topics with you through interviews with content experts.
Welcome, AOP listeners. This is Kevin McPherson, and we are continuing our interviews of various presenters from the 2020 AOMPT Virtual Conference. I have the privilege of interviewing Dr. Bradley Myers today regarding his presentation titled Evaluating Research is Greater Than P-Values Alone, A Clinician's Guide to Interpreting Statistical Influence. Now, before we get too far into it, yes, this will be a statistically heavy discussion. However, the statistics that we talk about are the ones that you're average clinician should have a good grasp of if they want to provide evidence-informed practice. I say that as somebody who, prior to his fellowship, really didn't have a good understanding of a lot of these values, and as somebody who is in the midst of their Doctor of Science degree and is learning more about these values, I can tell you that I put way too much weight on some of the articles that I have previously read because I didn't understand these values. So I think this is going to be a very valuable discussion for all of our listeners. So let's give you some background on Dr. Myers. Brad did receive his bachelor's degree in health, fitness, and preventative rehabilitative programs from Central Michigan University prior to undergoing his clinical doctorate in physical therapy from Duke University. He subsequently underwent his academic doctorate training with a Doctor of Science degree from Andrews University, and he is a fellow of our academy, having undergone his training at my fellowship alma mater, Regis University. His clinical experience does include management of complex musculoskeletal dysfunctions throughout the body, but his research endeavors seem to hone around the appropriate application of manual therapy techniques with exercise interventions for orthopedic dysfunctions, as well as the identification of motor control dysfunctions that are either precursor or resultant to musculoskeletal impairments. So these things being said, Brad, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me on the podcast. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So am I, and I want to say that your presentation did a very good job of putting these arguably ambiguous items or values in a way or in a manner that a clinician could understand. So I think you should give yourself some kudos on being able to put things into maybe not so much layman's terms, but clinician terms.
That was kind of the intent, was to try and bring it home to what happens in the clinic, and being predominantly, you know, my history is being a clinician more so than a heavy end researcher. I needed to bring it down into, like you said, maybe more layman's terms to really understand it, because it's easy to get confused quite a bit.
And like I said, you did a great job. Now, that being said, do you mind giving us kind of a brief overview of the presentations and maybe just quickly discuss some of those values that you are trying to or were trying to and succeeding on bringing light to?
Sure. So to start, I think, you know, the title kind of says it at the beginning, is when we're evaluating research, you know, p-values are important, but what we need to do as we talk about what it means in the clinic is look at more than p-values. And I think you alluded to it is, you know, in PT training and our initial looks at research, most of us have kind of put a lot of emphasis on that p-value. Like, that was like a nice little component to say, okay, when the p-value is a certain level, like p.05, that means that this study is meaningful. That means that I can take whatever finding that the researchers describe and have confidence that it means something important to the clinic. And unfortunately, it's just not that simple. And the p-value itself has been probably receiving too much emphasis, especially by clinicians, but not just clinicians, people across all modes of research and literature, in terms of its outweighed importance for what we do to interpret a finding. And like, the statisticians themselves have actually been arguing about this for a number of different years, at least 60 years. There's been different articles about whether the p-value is actually something that's very useful or not. And so since the statisticians are arguing about it, and they're trying to come up with a better way to interpret these types of findings, they actually presented a statement in 2016, the American Statistical Association, where it kind of described what the heck these things really are, and how we may use p-values and how we maybe shouldn't use p-values. And so that's kind of where I wanted to jump off and make sure that clinicians kind of understood that basic thing. You know, what are the statisticians telling us about p-values and maybe how we're interpreting them improperly, so to speak. And unfortunately, that's where my knowledge came from, right? My knowledge was this p-value, p.05 is important. And then I would just go from there. But the statisticians essentially told us that that's not what a p-value means, right? A p-value actually isn't the probability of chance or random error finding from a study. It actually doesn't tell us anything about the effect or the meaningfulness of a result from a specific research project. Essentially, it's just the representation of how the data that was collected for a study fits a statistical model, and whether the finding in a population would be larger than or equal to the finding found in that sample study. And so it's useful, but essentially the statisticians are telling us that it's not enough in and of itself to make a judgment about the quality of an outcome from a study. And then there's things that we have seen and heard about in PT that are actually useful to kind of bring in to context to make a clinical decision, essentially. And those things like effect sizes and MDC and MCID and confidence intervals, these are terms that most of us probably gloss over in studies and did in our research program or research classes in our DPT program or PT program. And unfortunately, they probably provide more importance than the p-value alone when interpreting clinical evidence.
So when we look at the p-value, one of the things that I think we naturally, as early clinicians and also now early evidence-informed or evidence-based practitioners, like to latch onto is that threshold to act, or that very clear distinction of this is yes, this is no. And when we look at it at a deeper level, having undergone fellowship training, you know, there's more nuances, there's more depth or more context that has to be taken into account with clinical care. It seems like what you're describing is the context of that p-value is as important, if not in some cases more important than the p-value itself. Am I hearing that correctly?
That's absolutely correct. The interesting thing about what we do in clinical practice, right, is there's no specific single way that any specific patient should be treated, right? We don't know this intervention or this condition is vastly superior to any other ones. In fact, there's probably this, you know, inherent gray area that we like to talk about where, you know, the patient's preferences, the clinician's preferences, and previous experience all kind of come in with the evidence to create the best environment for that patient. And that's kind of the same situation that we find with these statistical measures, is the p-value is meaningful only to an extent, but the other contextual factors, like those other measures I was talking about, MCID, MDC, Cohen's D effect sizes, and like the confidence intervals of all these data, give us more context. It gives us more kind of flavor to what's happening to then make better decisions. And I think that even though most of us as clinicians kind of, if you're primarily a clinician and not a researcher, you're going to say, I don't need to know the numbers. I don't need to know this. I'm a clinician. I just need to know what's going on in the clinic. I think it's actually a better situation that clinicians can take context, because we do it every day. You can take contextual factors and make a decision based upon clinical care. And that's really what I'm saying we should be doing. And the evidence now is saying we should be doing with these statistical factors as well.
So let's break them down a little bit more before we go much further. If we look at the p-value, and I take more of a traditionalist's definition, really, if we say that p equal, or we want p to be less than 0.05, that number would mean that there's less than a 5% chance that the observed difference between two averages or two means of the two different samples you have will be at least as extreme as what you found with your analysis if the null hypothesis, the hypothesis that there's no difference, is actually correct. I have watched so many videos on YouTube of different researchers trying to explain that in layman's terms, and it just gets really garbled. How would you put it to help a clinician understand, what does that p-value actually mean?
So I would say that the p-value, it represents the fit of a measured or observed finding, so what you did in the study, to the same value, so if it's a mean of a specific measure, if we did that for an entire population, right? It doesn't describe how important that effect is. It actually doesn't describe an effect at all. It just tells us if the statistical model that was used to compare the sample's measured or observed value against what we would assume it to be in the population is likely to be the same or different, right? And we use that p.05 value to kind of a threshold to tell us if it's something we should put confidence in, so to speak.
And when we look at confidence, and we also, let's stick with the p-value for a second. Let's say that the p-value of the study does not meet that 0.05 threshold. I've heard two different ways of explaining what that means. One is that you would accept the null hypothesis, that there's no difference between your two samples. But I've also heard that it really should be interpreted as it's a failure to reject the null hypothesis. Almost more in line with research is going to give you evidence for or against, but you can't really prove it. Which one do you find to be the more correct statement or have a better or a higher belief in?
It's an interesting question. I probably used both of them. But if we really think about it in terms of what we're trying to do, I think that failing to reject the null is probably a more precise definition, because realistically in any two groups, there's going to be some difference no matter what, right? That difference might be infinitesimally small to where we can't actually measure it, but any two groups, no matter what we measure, there's going to be a difference. So if we want to go from a true academic argument, the failure to reject the null is probably a more correct statement than accepting the null, because the null in most times will tell you that essentially the two groups are the same, and inherently we can't get the same in any measure that we do. So failure to reject the null is probably a little bit more correct. But what's interesting is if we take it a little bit further and say, maybe we need to get away from this language completely. So there's evidence now, again, from statisticians that are saying that this language isn't necessarily helpful for us. Because if we're saying we're rejecting the null or accepting the null, we're finding statistical significance, that kind of pollutes our reasoning into putting an overabundant amount of weight to that specific statement. Statistically significant, no matter what we write or read thereafter in the results section or the discussion of a paper, your head is already kind of fixated. It's anchored to that statistical significance component, and that may not be in the best interest of our clinical decision making forward. So I can say that failure to reject the null is probably more correct in my reasoning. I could see how people would say accept the null. That could be correct. But in the long run, we probably should kind of deviate away from that language completely because of what it can do to our reasoning.
So that kind of speaks to the idea of looking at the p-value as a spectrum versus a threshold, right? So I might, you know, as a clinician say, oh, well, their p-value, the cutoff value it didn't meet. So it wasn't less than 0.05, let's say it was 0.06. As a clinician, if I look at the context of some of the other variables that we'll talk about in a second, it's not a like, okay, done with that. It's more of a, well, I know it's maybe not as strong of a statement for the model that's being applied to whatever the study is. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to at least look at this and potentially apply what the findings are to my clinical practice. Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely. So yeah, the P.05 is definitely not a threshold. It doesn't do anything to dichotomize our data in terms of this is good, this is bad. And depending upon the type of research that's being done, like obviously P.05 is the standard. That's what we all pretty much are used to seeing. But that p-value really set before the study sample is collected, the data is collected, people will set the alpha level, which is the level that they're comparing that p-value to, at 0.1 or 0.01 or 0.001, depending upon the type of study they're looking for. So there's already this kind of risk assessment on how much tolerance you have to being essentially incorrect with your rejection or failure to reject the null hypothesis. So there's already some subjectivity to it from the researcher's standpoint that that is baked into the equation from the beginning. We just have to remember that. So the sliding scale here is just a point of a start for our clinical reasoning to interpret what we're finding in a study.
So let's move into to interpretation, and let's move into your other variables. One that I think probably more clinicians are familiar with are these ideas of detectable change. So we've got the MDC, the minimal detectable change, arguably more of a statistical cutoff value for an instrument. If you hit this amount of change on that instrument, statistically, there's a difference. And then you have the MCID, so the minimally clinically important difference. And this is oftentimes anchor-based, in which they use a tool, let's say the LEFS or the ODI, and they look for an amount of change, and then they compare the change that they see to another validated measure. Oftentimes, it's maybe the global rating of change scale, so a Likert scale where you've got -7, +7, and somebody who has a decrease in whatever that variable is has the minus area. Somebody who has improvement has the plus area, and then they'll use thresholds. So that kind of gives the listeners kind of a basic definition between those. When we look at the MDC and the MCID, I think where there can be some confusion on the clinician's part might be when you have both and you're not really sure which one to use. So I'm going to give you maybe not a common example, but an example where you might have the minimal detectable change, so the statistical change value being, say, a 2.0 on a scale that goes from 0 to 10. And then you have a MCID, that clinically important, being 1.5, which is less than the MDC or that statistical. Like, what should a clinician go for? Should they go for the clinically important change, or should, in this case, they go for that statistical important change?
So that's a really good question, because it's something I know that, you know, has confused me throughout clinical practice, and I didn't know which one to go for, and essentially I would just pick, right, or guess based upon what the literature provided me. It's hard to say, to be clear, right? So the MDC itself, like you said, is a statistical measure, right? It tells us about the responsiveness of the tool and whether the tool itself, if it was a numeric pain rating scale or even goniometry or anything, the ability of that tool to be responsive to change. So it can't actually differentiate between things that are smaller than that 2.0. We don't know if it's an actual change until it's gotten bigger than that level. Whereas the MCID, the patient gives us that context, like you said, with the graph. And so the patient is actually telling us with another validated measure that they're improving and we're measuring change on the specific scale that you're using. So without being specific, I think that both are important. I think that the MCID is helpful to understand if the patient has value in the plan that we're providing and the interventions that we're providing. So a 1.5 on MCID for a numeric pain rating scale or something, for instance, is beneficial to the patient, but I'm still not sure if that actually represents a true change on that 10-point scale, because the scale itself has a limited responsiveness of 2. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And I think, like, clinically, if we were to even expand it a little bit, and I'm going to look more at students, maybe novice practitioners. The other thing that I have conveyed, and tell me if I'm right or wrong in this thought process, is, if you take the context of the patient, you take other variables such as irritability and severity of complaints, which arguably is not oftentimes recorded in your research materials or in your articles. Maybe the argument is, should you aim for a bare minimum in change, or should you potentially look for a higher amount of change when you're doing goal setting, when you're working with your patients to establish a goal? What are your thoughts on having more of a contextual cutoff value for goals as opposed to those minimum thresholds?
Yeah, I think that's probably what we inherently do as clinicians more often, right? As opposed to writing, say, for instance, a goal that says the person's going to have a 2-point reduction in numeric pain rating scale. Well, that's great, but can they actually do what they need to do in life? And I think that contextual component is really what we need to be looking at more so, because even when we talk about an MVC or an MCID and using those as cutoff values one way or another, there's a lot of variability in how those data were collected. And if the study that reported an MVC or an MCID had a different population or a different subset of the population, a different sample than yours, than your patient you have in your clinic, who knows if that MDC that we're using or the MCID we're using is actually appropriate for the given patient. So again, it's not a clear, clean answer. It's just it informs us that we're moving in the right direction. And I think if we're in that range where, MCID and MBC are 1.5 and 2 maybe, that's pretty much the same thing, right? So if we're saying the person's moving in that direction, that's good. We're taking in the rest of the contextual factors of irritability. That's generally moving in the right direction. And then over time, if it continues to move that direction, we'll exceed both the MDC and MCID most likely.
Indeed. And that I think that's a good point when we go back to what you said about populations and seeing how those variables are really dependent on the population in which the MCID was derived from. And you wouldn't want to potentially use the MCID for, say, patellofemoral pain syndrome on, say, the lower extremity functional scale as your threshold, if your patient has a ACL tear and they happen to be a COBRA and you're trying to use that. They might be different metrics for that MCID since those are different populations.
That's absolutely correct.
Now, the other, or one of the other metrics that you were discussing in there was also effect size. And I think this one is probably one that is not as recognizable of a value for clinicians. What is effect size? Explain what that is for our audience.
Okay, so effect size, usually if you're looking in an article, there's a number of different ways it can be reported, but the most common is Cohen's d. And so Cohen's d, essentially, it's a scale from 0 that goes up, and it looks very similar to like a correlation coefficient scale, right? So it's a 0.1 or a 0.2 or a 0.9, and so higher numbers are better. And essentially what it looks at is the difference between the mean value of the measure you're comparing between two groups. So if it's a population and your sample, or if it's between two samples that had different interventions, it's looking at the difference in that mean and then dividing it by the standard deviation, right? And so essentially, if you have a Cohen's d effect size of 1, the difference between those means is 1 standard deviation. Now, there's been a bunch of things reported about how we interpret the magnitude of a Cohen's d. And so normally we'll talk about something like a 0.2 is a small effect size, a 0.5 is moderate, 0.8 is considered large, and then they can actually go up to to infinity, actually, depending upon the variables of interest. But usually, if we're at that 0.5 level, we're thinking this is a pretty significant effect. So whatever we're measuring, there's a difference between the groups. But that doesn't really give us a lot of usefulness in the clinic. What is helpful is the effect size using Cohen's D allows us to compare different groups and different interventions in a standardized fashion. So if you're comparing two different interventions, you say this intervention is supposed to have an effect size of 0.2, this intervention is supposed to have an effect size of 0.8. I can choose the effect size of 0.8 because it's going to have a larger difference between the means of the intervention groups. And so for that regard, it's helpful, but it doesn't give us a lot of kind of meaning in the clinic, where like MCID and MDC are a little bit more tangible for us. The effect size is helpful. Cohen's D is helpful, but again, it doesn't give us something to cleanly interpret. And sometimes what people will say is, okay, well, if it's Cohen's D of 0.5, well, that's moderate. I need to have things above 0.5 to consider them to be clinically meaningful, which isn't necessarily wrong. Unfortunately, most of the things that we do in physical therapy have much smaller effect sizes than 0.5. We have effect sizes, 0.2, 0.3 that we actually consider to be really good. And that just makes things a little bit more muddy again, right? So it's the confluence of circumstances in that we don't usually just do one thing with our patients, like we might try and do in a study to identify which is better, this or that. And so the effect size is helpful, but clinically not as helpful as MCID or MDC.
So with that in mind, there was one other kind of variable that was mentioned in the presentation that maybe does have a little bit more meaningfulness when comparing different means, no pun intended, but different values across the two different groups or whatever number you have in your study. And that was confidence intervals. Tell us about confidence intervals.
So confidence intervals are, in my opinion, they were an eye-opening thing to start to understand. And you know, usually they're reported in a study as parentheses after, say, a mean for a measure. And so it's like mean of the numeric pain rating scale, and then parentheses, two numbers with a semicolon in between them with a 95% confidence interval. Essentially, what this means is that mean, in this instance, a numeric pain rating scale measurement for a group, is a point estimate. Essentially, it's our best guess based upon the data of what that mean is. But the 95% confidence interval gives us a lower bound and a higher bound that is where that mean actually likely falls for a population. So we have a 95% confidence that in a population, the point estimate that we have, somewhere in that range from low to high bound, is actually what the population change is for the intervention that we're talking about. So when we talk about confidence intervals, sometimes it's interesting to say confidence intervals can be really, really broad, really, really wide, and they can be really, really narrow. It's, again, something we have to interpret a little bit. So if we're talking about something that has an MDC, for instance, of 2, but the confidence intervals anywhere from 1.5 to 10, that means that in the population, that MDC could be anywhere from 1.5 to 10. Well, if it's 1.5, that's below, you know, something that's really useful to me. But if it's 10, that's really outstanding and I should be using it. So we have to start to interpret, is the true possibility of the representation of that value in the population a meaningful amount, right? So if there's a possibility to have a broad confidence interval or a narrow confidence interval, and then you can look at the worst case scenario, essentially, of is the worst case of the 95% confidence interval still a good finding for me and my patient? If that's the case, great. I have more confidence that there's going to be a beneficial effect. However, if the confidence interval is way broad or the lower bound is way too low, I'm not really sure if there's going to be a meaningful effect, even if that point estimate, that mean that the study calculated, looks good. So it gives us, again, more context on how quality this data is and what the spread of the data in the sample is, represented within a nice little little set of parentheses after that point estimate.
I think that last part is also good to pan out a little bit more for the listeners is the how wide the confidence interval is, what the size is. Is there a very large difference? And one of the things that I've learned from the width, so the difference between the lower bound and the upper bound on the confidence interval is that if it's wide, it can be attributed to having a smaller sample size, which could mean that you have more heterogeneity across that change value in your sample. If you have potentially a larger sample size, that mean will start to kind of move closer and closer to what the true population value is, and therefore you'd have a smaller confidence interval. Am I tracking right on that?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting because sometimes when we look about like a heterogeneous grouping or a homogeneous grouping for samples for research, we want a homogeneous group so it's easier to detect change. But that also gives us challenges when we start to take that data from a specific study and apply it to our clinical population, in which they don't really meet the specific inclusion-exclusion criteria of that group that value was calculated on. So there's strengths and weaknesses in having that homogeneous group. And one of the homogeneous group benefits is you get a tight confidence interval usually. But even with a broad confidence interval, there's the potential that it can be very, very meaningful if we look at the lower or the higher bound, whichever is most important for the measure that you're looking for, where it still represents an amount of difference between groups that is meaningful related to worst case scenario, for instance.
So let's give you a scenario and let's try to wrap some of these things together. And in this scenario, I know we just talked about confidence intervals. You sound like you love confidence intervals just as much as I love confidence intervals, which speaks to our nerdiness, but I'm going to leave them out for this scenario. And the only reason why is I don't want the listeners to have to pull over their car and start taking notes on things. So I'm going to give you a scenario minus the confidence intervals. So we have a basic randomized control trial. Let's say that there are two interventions, so just two arms to that trial. And they're using just a simple student t-test to analyze differences in the change score of a measure. So this group, they had this much change. This second group had this much change, comparing those. When they do the statistical analysis, let's say they find the p-value is equal to 0.12. Let's say that the alpha was 0.05, which was what they were looking to cross, but they got 0.12. They reported an effect size, so a Cohen's d of 0.85, which if we use kind of your cutoff values, that would be a high amount of change attributed to this intervention. And the experimental treatment shows that there was a greater mean improvement on a tool of 2.1 compared to the other treatment or the comparator intervention. However, the MCID for that tool is 2.3, so it doesn't meet the threshold. So we have a p-value that is higher than 0.05, we have an effect size that is high, and we have a difference in mean of 2.1, but the MCID for that tool is 2.3. Do we adopt this new intervention or this comparator intervention? What does a clinician do with this info?
Yeah, these are, I think as a clinician, it's frustrating. But I think the researcher who came up with these values is actually more frustrated because it's potentially so close in certain regards, but then not in others. So how I would look at this is the p-value tells us that, you know, it didn't meet that alpha level, and statistically alone, it doesn't say it's significant. But like we said, that doesn't tell me enough. So I'm going to go to the standardized Cohen's D here, which was 0.85, which, like you said, is a large value. That's actually pretty big, especially for clinical stuff from PT. So to me, that tells me there is a difference between the groups enough, at least. It's almost one standard deviation different. So there's something here, whether or not it's meaningful clinically, I don't know. And then the mean improvement, so if it's 2.1 and the MCID is 2.3, is that what you said? So if it's the mean improvement of the intervention group is just below what the level is for the patient to actually report a change or an important difference, this is a little bit of a challenge. What I would say is, you know, I would love those confidence intervals because that would tell me if more people maybe were allowed to appreciate an important difference at the MVC or MCID. But realistically, at this point, I'm going to come at it and say there's possibly something here. It may not be everything. It may not be the only intervention or the best thing overall, but I don't know unless I can compare it to something else that I'm going to maybe do or not do in the clinic. So to me, then it becomes an opportunity cost. There's the possibility that this is beneficial in the clinic, but it's not a home run. What am I going to do instead of it, right? And that's when I would take that contextual thing in, like we talked about a little bit, is what's the patient's perception? You know, if we're talking about manual therapy, for instance, and this patient has had a previous beneficial experience with manipulation, manual therapy, had pain reduction and improvement in function, I'm probably going to do this intervention with them if they don't have risk factors or serious pathology, because my interpretation clinically is that there's a possibility that this could be good enough or get me closer to an MCID with this specific patient. But it definitely doesn't tell me that I can't do this intervention or that this intervention can't be good just because of that p-value itself.
So that your response is reinforcing to me as a both an educator, but also as a clinician. One of the things that I have told my students and I tell other practitioners is if you have the ability to track your own personal data, one of the ways that you can look at some of these articles where it's just like, well, it's close, it's not really there. However, I don't feel like I'm offering the best possible outcomes for my patients within that population or that diagnosis or whatnot, is to, you know, add it, start to do whatever that is, replace whatever you were previously doing that was the comparator, and track your outcomes and look for a change on your end. Was there a substantial change on your end? If there was, then you should probably keep that new intervention. If there wasn't, you should probably go back to the previous one. But the only way that a clinician can do that is if they're actually taking these measurements. I feel like I've been vindicated by your response. Do you think that maybe I overinterpreted or I had some bias in there?
Well, I think that's the whole system is bias prone, right? From the beginning of all of this. And so like we talked about the p-value being, you know, 0.05 is important. Well, that's a bias from the beginning. There's bias at every level of research and how we interpret it and then apply it within the clinic. And so the idea is just making sure that we're not trying to confirm our own biases. And so collecting data is helpful, right, for quality control and improvement. And you may not have enough of a sample size within your own data to say, hey, this is clearly better to do. But, you know, ask the patient's perspective. That's where we have to come back as clinicians and say, do you think that this was helpful or not? And if they do, great, we use it. And it's always muddy. It's always difficult because we don't just do one thing with our patients, right? We're prioritizing so many different interventions, so many different things within the resources that the patient has, both in time and then obviously insurance dollars, that we have to make decisions. And that's probably part of the fun of what we do, in my opinion. It just is sometimes confusing because it's easier to say, you know, this hit the MCID in this study from 2018. I'm going to do it on all my patients. I've yet to see a study that's good, you know, that's that good. So we have to think, which is fun for the nerdy folks in the room.
Well, it's leaving me with plenty more to contemplate throughout our conversation. And I really like how you brought that back to the N of one, that person, that patient in front of you is really the only one that truly, truly matters when we're looking at that and how to best serve that person. So, Brad, as we start to close things up, are there other projects that are in the pipeline that our listeners should be listening or on the lookout for coming out of you?
Yeah, so we have a couple clinical studies going on right now. We we have something going on with a couple of manual fellows who are helping us through some data collection, looking at cervical retraction strength with a handheld dynamometer. We've kind of created a reliable and valid measure, and we're trying to look at how cervical retraction strength actually changes over time, kind of looking at how it associates, so we can create an MCID that's a little bit more appropriate and then correlate it again to what type of interventions people have. So that's in process right now. And then I also have some interesting stuff going on too in terms of measurement of internal and external load in collegiate athletes. So really kind of changing the whole perspective here and seeing, you know, when we measure load differences like performance, like people will talk about acute chronic workload and all these other different things that are happening. Can we try to find threshold levels for importance related to athletic performance, and then also then taking it to injury risk? And so it's kind of closing the circle on the back end. But that's going to be multiple years before we can close that loop.
And then Brad, I know that you'll probably have some listeners that are interested and have more questions or have some comments. What's the best way for our listeners to be able to reach out to you?
Yeah, so email is great. So my email is bmyers@campbell.edu. That's bmyers@campbell, campbell.edu. And then I'm on Twitter as well. So @BradMyers, DPT. So feel free to reach out, and I'd be happy to have conversations or email chains with anybody.
Brad, thank you for that. And thank you for a wonderful conversation on a topic that clinicians really should have a good understanding of, so that they can make those sound reasoning processes. We look forward to more information and more good stuff out of you. But until then, I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This has been a production of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. You can learn more about the Academy by visiting our website at aaompt.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for our acronym, AAOMPT. The views and opinions expressed on the AOMPT podcast are those of the interviewers and interviewees and do not represent the official position of AOMPT. The information presented should not be used as personal health care or clinical practice advice. If you need to find an expert orthopedic physical therapist near you, then check out the Find a Fellow feature under the Public Resources tab at www.aaompt.org, which you can find in the show notes.